This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about a recent phenomenon on college campuses whereby invited guest speakers are booed and shut down and asked to leave.
Well, John Stuart Mill famously said the answer to bad speech is more speech, but we're not sure that's what's going on campus these days. And Will Creeley from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, is going to talk to us about this worrisome topic.
Austin Carson from Tech Freedom joins us to talk about proposed legislation to close the so-called backdoor search, preventing our data from being as easily accessible as it already is.
After 9/11, we predicted that a police surveillance state was emerging. What's the status of this now?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Last week, an invited lawmaker was shut down from addressing Texas Southern University after protesters stormed the room, calling him a racist. House Representative Briscoe Cain was asked to speak at the Thurgood Marshall School of Law by the Federalist Society about the recent legislative special session. But as he began to utter a few words, he was shut down by students and then by the university's president, who claimed it was an unapproved event. There's irony in the fact that the school is named for the Supreme Court justice known for his exemplary record of protecting First Amendment rights. Attorney General Jeff Sessions also spoke recently, uninterrupted, at Georgetown University about free speech on American campuses. He said, quote, "The right of free speech does not exist only to protect the ideas upon which most of us agree at a given moment in time." He encouraged students to, quote, "make your voices heard and to defend the rights of others to do the same." Sessions joins a bipartisan chorus of public officials expressing support for free speech in academic institutions. This summer, Senators Bernie Sanders and Mitch McConnell condemned efforts to shut down differing viewpoints at schools. And in 2015, Barack Obama more than once defended the importance of free speech on campus. He said, "I don't agree that you, when you become students at colleges, have to be coddled and protected from different points of views." He said that at a 2015 town hall. The Sessions talk comes amid an uptick in efforts to disinvite controversial speakers of all ideological persuasions, along with the use of bias response teams to monitor unpopular speech, and also unprecedented violence aimed at silencing off-campus speakers. These are some of the findings from a recent study from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE. The comprehensive survey on students' attitudes about free speech measured responses to questions about hate speech, guest speakers, self-expression, and reaction to expression of other students. Joining us to talk about the state of free speech on campus is Will Creeley, Senior Vice President of Legal and Public Advocacy at FIRE. FIRE is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to defending liberty, freedom of speech, due process, academic freedom, legal equality, and freedom of conscience on America's college campuses. Will, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Will, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders has called on University of Las Vegas to investigate one of its professors, Tessa Winkleman, who criticized President Donald Trump and the consequences of his election as the city was reeling from a mass shooting. What are your reactions to this?
Well, we were very disappointed by the press secretary's comments. The professor's speech, while controversial to some or many, is clearly protected by the First Amendment and cannot be subjected to investigation. We made clear in a public statement on our website that investigations into protected classroom speech by faculty are incompatible with basic precepts of academic freedom. If you investigate professors for speech such as Professor Winkleman's, you will effectively chill discussions in the place where they most need to happen, in our college campuses and in their classrooms.
We're going to talk about the survey that FIRE recently conducted in a few minutes, but I wanted to first ask you if you have noticed a trend of students, in effect, reporting on their teachers when they feel somehow offended by their speech.
Unfortunately, we have seen that kind of activity increase in recent years, and it's happened on both the left and the right, and I should note that it's not just students, it's also folks from outside of campus, that is the general public. It's pretty disturbing. We've seen professors subjected to death threats, to classroom interruptions, to very nasty online harassment, behavior that looks to be akin to criminal stalking for political speech most often. Now, whenever one kind of enters the fray of democratic discourse in our society, one can expect criticism. But criticism is very different from death threats. I mean, that is should be clear to anybody. Unfortunately, professors have been on the receiving end of some very disturbing threats in recent months for their speech. And I think in this polarized political climate, unfortunately, I worry about seeing more of that.
Exactly. And I would assume that one of the byproducts of this would be a self-censorship on the part of instructors. And we're going to talk in a little bit about students who self-censor because of that. But I wanted to ask you about something I'd not heard of before that was mentioned on your website, and that is bias response teams. What are those?
Well, bias response teams are university bodies typically staffed by administrators, often with law enforcement officials on them, that in their basic format are designed to respond to quote-unquote incidents of bias, right, as the name implies. But of course, as with anything involving civil liberties, the definition is the crux of the matter. How does one define a bias incident? One person's bias incident is another person's manifesto, as we would say in First Amendment law. And what happens, no matter how well-intentioned these teams are, what happens is that students are taught to report to the authorities speech that they dislike or that they find upsetting for whatever reason. So we issued, in order to prepare a report we issued in the spring, we issued open records requests to public universities nationwide to find out what kind of speech was being reported to bias incident response teams. And it really ran the gamut. And most depressingly, a lot of the speech was core protected political speech, whether that's expressions of support for political candidate, Black Lives Matter, other activist groups. Students who didn't like either the candidate or the group would report their fellow students for speaking out on their favor. And that's, again, the exact wrong lesson to send to folks who are learning to live in our democracy, that when you don't like speech, the answer is to call the authorities and ask somebody to investigate. That's really chilling, and we're concerned about it. At public universities, which are bound by the First Amendment, bias response teams need to make clear that they will not investigate speech protected by the First Amendment and that they will not punish students or faculty for speaking out on issues they care about when that speech is protected.
Will, do you see any justification at all for having a biased response team? And secondly, how prevalent are they?
Well, I think that there is arguably a way to do it that doesn't infringe upon the First Amendment. If a bias response team's function is to talk to a student who feels troubled by what she or he has heard and to connect them with university resources, I think that that's probably maybe even helpful to students, right? To say, hey, you're not alone. If you're upset or depressed, we have people you can talk to, no problem. That's, you know, connecting students with resources without telling the student who spoke and exercise his or her First Amendment rights that they need to shut up. That's okay. I think that's probably a best-case scenario here. Unfortunately, our research indicates they are fairly prevalent, and they are, I think, likely to continue to spread again, what's interesting here, FIRE is a nonpartisan group, and we've seen concern about bias response teams from people on both the left and the right. In the New Republic in the past year, two professors wrote about the chilling effect they find in their classrooms, knowing that if they broach controversial subjects, students who disagree with their political viewpoints may report them to the bias response team, and then they'll have to expect an administrative response to their speech. So this may be a case of good intentions gone awry, and there may be a right way to do it, but right now too many schools are investigating students and faculty for protected speech.
Yeah, I have to say, I find it offensive. I don't think students should be coddled whatsoever, but I think what's going on now is that students are treated as consumers. At some of the schools, they get $50,000, $60,000 a year in tuition out of them, and what the students want, the students get. I mean, they'll even protest a bad grade and try to get it, you know, increased. So I think that that's a very worrisome trend, the kind of power that students have over the professors.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with your excellent point about a kind of the customer is always right mindset that we see increasingly. And it goes hand in hand with increased tuitions and the university becoming kind of a small corporate nation state unto itself. And I'm very sympathetic as somebody who recently paid off student loans. I'm very sympathetic to the predicament of students who are saddled with high tuition costs. And I do not want to place all the blame on students. But you're right, there's a growing kind of corporatist ideal of the university as the provider of all solutions to all problems that a student might have. And students may increasingly be taught to seek comfort rather than challenge. And I think the blame for that impulse may lie on the universities themselves rather than solely students. But it's a knotty problem, and I certainly share your concern about it.
Will, last week Representative Briscoe Cain was shut down after being invited, I believe, by the Federalist Society to speak at Texas Southern Thurgood Marshall Law School. How do you think that was handled?
Boy, we're still looking into this one. Our understanding was that State Representative Briscoe Cain had been cleared to speak, the group had been informed that the event would be able to happen without issue, that there would be an opportunity for folks to protest, et cetera. But the fact that he was shouted down without being allowed to speak at all, I think, is worrisome. Justice Thurgood Marshall famously noted that freedom to speak and freedom to listen are two sides of the same coin, that preventing somebody from speaking is a threat to the conception of the First Amendment and the fundamental principles that underlie the rough and tumble of democratic discourse. And so when the response to a speaker that one doesn't like is to simply prevent them from speaking, I worry that that kind of vigilante impulse will really leave all of us blind, because if that kind of response is seized upon by partisans on all sides, pretty soon none of us will be speaking to anybody except those who already agree with us. And that, again, that kind of increasing balkanization, I think, is a death knell for our civil discourse and our ability to solve problems together. So I did not take much comfort in the way the university responded. It appears that Texas Southern is claiming there was some kind of procedural problem with the way the student group organized the event. But I think that seems to be a fig leaf. Right now we're talking to the state representative and students at the school to try and learn more.
I'm interested, and I know Michael is as well, to hear about some of the results of the survey that FIRE recently conducted on student attitudes about free speech. Now, one of the aspects that you queried them on was on this very issue of disinviting people to speak on campus because of anticipation of unpopular views. Were you surprised by any of the findings? And briefly, what were the results of that?
Well, yeah, I was surprised. I'll give you a couple of the key takeaways from our survey, which was released just this week. A majority of students, 93% of students that we surveyed, agreed that schools should invite a variety of guest speakers to campus. And 64% agreed to having said they had had their attitudes or opinions about an issue changed after listening to a guest speaker, which I think is great. I thought that was one of the really hopeful signs here. There's an apocryphal story attributed to John Maynard Keynes, a great economist, about where someone is querying him about why his views have shifted over time, and I'm paraphrasing wildly here, but the story goes that he said, "Well, when presented with facts that that indicate I'm wrong, I change my mind. What do you do, sir?" You know, which is great.
Right.
Which I like that that recognition of one's own fallibility. Right. What we may not always have all the answers. My boss Craig Lukianoff calls it epistemic humility, and I'm all for that. keep your mind open, right? Know what you know, but be open to hearing from other folks. So I thought that was a great finding. Let's see. Majority of students who supported the idea of disinvitations, who thought that sometimes there was a reason that a student should be disinvited, thought that this should happen if the student speaker has made racist or hateful comments. And that's an interesting finding. I'm always reminded of the time that former Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad came to Columbia University and spoke to students, and President Lee Bollinger prefaced his remarks saying, you know, let's hear what he has to say. We disagree with him on many issues, but let's hear him. And one of the things that Ahmadinejad said was that in Iran there are no gay people, which I think is just an amazing thing to say, and really indicates just how out of touch and living in his own reality Ahmadinejad was. You know, and the point being is that when you invite speakers that you disagree with, you can sharpen your own arguments against them. And also, a point worth repeating here is you can also just ignore them.
Exactly.
You know, that's a great skill in our democracy as well, is to just say, look, you are a provocateur, you are not serious, you are not interested to me, you are offensive to me, I'm going to do something else. I will, you know, I don't even have to have a counter-protest. I'll just deny you the opportunity to talk to me.
Well, the famous quote from John Stuart Mill is that the answer to bad speech is more speech. That's the principle of the American Civil Liberties Union. And I think that's a good principle, and I think
right on.
Quashing anybody's speech doesn't help any of us. I went to the University of Wisconsin in the 60s, and there was a plaque on Bascom Hall, which is the main building at the Liberal Arts School. It's a plaque that was put up in 1894. It was a statement by the Board of Regents after the Board of Regents defended a socialist economics professor who had incited the reactionary press, and they tried to get him fired. And the Board of Regents supported him, and they put this quote in brass on the wall of Bascom Hall, which so impressed me at the time that I still remember it, and I'm going to read it. I'm going to read it to you and ask you for your response. And the quote says, "Whatever the limitations that trammel free speech elsewhere, we at the great state University of Wisconsin shall forever encourage the fearless sifting and winnowing by which alone the truth may be found."
Oh, I love it, and I know it well. And as soon as you said Wisconsin and Madison, I was hoping that this might be it. We talk about sifting and winnowing all the time here at FIRE. It is the absolute, the beautiful specificity of it. It's a beautiful articulation of the type of thought that we hope to defend the right of folks to engage in here. In fact, that's made such an impression on me, too, over the years that I talk about it at home. My wife will tell you I often talk about sifting and winnowing. We've got two small children, and, you know, that's a kind of an exercise in trial and error to see what works and what doesn't in terms of making sure your kids are happy and well-adjusted. So we are sifting and winnowing at home as well. I think that's great. I think that is it's a guiding ethos for me personally, and certainly for the work we do here at FIRE.
When I was there during the 60s, when the anti-war movement was getting started and the war in Vietnam was cooking up, the State Department sent out spokespeople to defend America's war against the Vietnamese. And we in the anti-war movement organized truth squads to counter them.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody
mm-hmm.
at the school mm-hmm. tried to shut down the State Department, and nobody at the school tried to shut us down. We put up our ideas against theirs, and we prevailed. And we built a huge
That's right.
anti-war movement on the campus with no interference on either side.
That's right. That's the way to do it. There's also that great quote from I think it's Milton, let truth and error, truth and falsehood grapple. Whoever knew truth to be put to the worst in a fair and open encounter. I mean, I honestly believe that. And this is why I think the First Amendment and free expression is ultimately optimistic work. You know, you have to believe in the power of reason to change minds for the better. And I do think that the arc of history bends toward justice, and I do think we get there not by violence, not by silencing people, but by convincing people, by persuading people. And if that makes me you know, out of touch or old-fashioned, then I'm afraid I will stick to it, because I cannot believe in violent coercion. I have to believe that I can change minds, and that's what we're fighting to defend here.
Will, I'm curious what the report found in terms of the numbers of students who say they self-censor during class.
Yeah, that's a good question. The numbers there were interesting. I'm just getting them up. They found that students are more likely to self-censor if they feel as though their words are going to offend others. You know, I think that in there is some degree of self-censorship that is just social interaction, like when people say no not to say, you know, if you have a friend who's going through a hard time, you maybe avoid a certain subject. But what's worrying is when self-censorship happens because you don't think others will be able to tolerate disagreement on a political idea. And so what we found is that in class, 30% of students have self-censored because they thought their words would be offensive to others. And more than 50% of the students who we talked to reported self-censoring in the classroom at some point since the beginning of college. And that particularly is disappointing because, again, the classroom should be where students feel free to try on ideas, to test out ideas, to see how their peers feel about their ideas without worries about reprimands. Or some kind of, you know, really harsh reaction. You know, I think that we have to try and foster a dynamic both in classroom and outside of the classroom where we take on ideas but allow people the possibility of having their minds changed. That if someone says something that you find horribly offensive, racist, homophobic, etc., you can take on their idea and do so with the hope that you can eventually convince them of the wrongness of that idea if you do think it's wrong. That's something I think that's worth noting. Also, we found that liberal students, very liberal students, are 14 percentage points more likely than their very conservative peers on the opposite side of the spectrum to feel comfortable expressing their opinions in the classroom. So that was interesting as well. We found that partisanship affected one's sense of comfort in terms of speaking out. And that, again, is disappointing. I'd like to find a situation where students, whether they're Democrats, Republicans, somewhere in between, Green Party folks, Libertarians, whomever, allow their ideas to battle it out in the classroom without worrying about getting in trouble.
Well, and that's also a problem for students who may not identify with one end of the political spectrum, but rather are there to learn, to help see what they might feel about certain subjects. And if it's so limited in terms of conversation, that's denying them one of the valuable opportunities that we send students to higher education institutions for.
Right.
Did you
right.
question teachers in terms of the amount of self-censorship that they do?
We just spoke to students in this study. That would be a fascinating speech, or a study to talk to teachers. I know that the American Association of University Professors and the National Coalition Against Censorship have issued reports on faculty attitudes towards campus speech in recent years. And we informally received many reports from faculty here about self-censorship because of concerns about being reported to administrators, just as we were discussing with regard to bias response teams. We know that faculty, particularly adjunct faculty, who are being relied upon more and more, really feel as though they're walking on eggshells. If they offend their conservative students, they might end up on one of these watch lists that outside groups are promoting, which we are very concerned about. And if they offend their liberal students, then maybe they will be subject to classroom interruptions, as just happened at Columbia University just this week. So,
what happened
yeah,
there? I'm sorry.
At Columbia, no problem. At Columbia University, a professor found her classroom interrupted. She was teaching her class and protesting students, I think about 15 of them, entered the classroom with signs, read a statement, and took over the classroom for about 2-3 minutes to protest. And the professor handled it, I thought, admirably. She informed the students that she'd be happy to talk to them another time, but she absolutely had to insist upon the integrity of her classroom and that they were violating university policy by interrupting her her instruction. The students, having said their piece, then left. But it's, as I told Inside Higher Ed this week, it's really easy to imagine that tactic being weaponized so that members of the general public or students on either side of the aisle start taking over classrooms and interrupting classroom instruction, which, again, is a real threat to academic freedom. I mean, we're already having professors receiving death threats. If they can't teach their classes without interruption, then something's gone wrong.
Well, it's worse than that. Texas, where they have an open carry law, the students can come into a classroom with a pistol on their hip. Imagine trying to teach in a situation like that.
Yeah, that's right. I've got a lot of sympathy for the tough work that professors do under normal circumstances, but these days, especially adjunct professors, the cases we receive from adjunct professors who have very limited job security, very limited protections, are really appalling. We've had adjunct professors with contracts not renewed, let go, told they can't teach classes for speaking out about issues of public concern. We had, for example, Kevin Allred at Montclair State University. He, on his Twitter account, was talking about the Trump administration and his serious disagreement with their policy positions, and he was doing it in a snarky way. And he found that despite having completed all the paperwork, being listed on the university's website as teaching a class in the fall, and receiving all assurances seemingly that he would be teaching, suddenly after conservative news outlets picked up some of his tweets, the university simply washed their hands of him, and he was erased from the website, told he would not be teaching, and he was left in the lurch. You know, I mean, again, adjunct faculty who don't have the protections of tenure are in a tough place here. So classroom interruptions or other threats to teaching need to be taken seriously.
Even with tenure, the Stephen Salida case at the University of Illinois 3 years ago is a good example.
Right.
I mean, he quit a job and came to the University of Illinois and was given tenure. And when it was found out that he was a Palestine Solidarity activist, one of the major donors called up one of the heads of the university and got him fired. And he had a contract with tenure.
Yeah.
And he'll probably never teach again. So if they can do that to a senior faculty member with tenure, you can imagine the terror that's filled in the minds of these younger faculty members who are trying to get work.
That's right.
Well, has the situation today been building gradually over the past decade or two? Or do you think that a series of incidents may have really escalated this intolerance for opposing viewpoints? How did we get here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been working this beat for FIRE since 2006, just after I graduated from law school. In undergrad at NYU, I did some activism for the Green Party and other progressive causes. Likewise, to some extent in law school, although I was a good deal busier. So I came from campus and went right into defending student rights. And I think that when I first arrived at FIRE in 2006, the classic antagonists in our cases were administrators. So they were the villains of the cases who were censoring students, who were cracking down on student protest or telling students that they would be punished for speaking their minds. Unfortunately, what's happened over the past 10 years, and I think there's a lot to be said about why, is that students themselves have been policing their fellow students in ways that go beyond just kind of the normal give and take and instead go to calls for censorship or outright disinvitation or silencing, and that's unfortunate, and makes me nervous about what happens next. I guess to answer your question, I think we're getting more balkanized, not less, and I imagine that some of it is because students who are on campus today have grown up in an increasingly polarized and fraught situation politically, and by the time they arrive on campus, they're not in the mood to try out new ideas or to hear others with whom they disagree with. They're in the mood to prove the righteousness of their own beliefs and convictions. So they've already decided that they are in the right and set out to quash the ability of those who may not have reached that conclusion or may have reached opposite conclusions to speak their minds. And, you know, that's a 30-second gloss on it. I think there are lots of other factors involved. Campuses have always, since the death of in loco parentis and the idea of the university as the parent of the students there, and since the desegregation and access to campus by women and other students, campuses have always been a microcosm for societal dispute and change. And I think that's in some ways a very good thing, because campuses are where future leaders are educated, and you have an opportunity to get it right at the campus level. But what makes me worried, and my colleagues here at FireWord, is that when students are using their voices to silence others, that doesn't bode well for what will happen when those students are elected officials. Right now we have a president in office who's been very contemptuous of First Amendment rights from the right. It would be really a disaster if those views were mirrored on the left. And we just together as a society on both sides of the aisle decided, look, to hell with free speech. It's all about power. Whoever's in power controls who can talk. And that is very scary to me. I guess what it means to me and other folks who believe in civil liberties protections is that we've got our work cut out for us. I have to make the case as to why defending free speech is not just defending the status quo, is not just defending white privilege, is not just defending the powers that be. I have to point out that free speech is how societal change happens, and we need to keep it alive and vibrant for all of us, whether we're in power or outside of power, to make sure that we can always change the direction that we're in as the facts present themselves.
One of the things that disturbs me is the whole notion of hate speech, because I find that within its definition is a certain censorship. What's FIRE's position on hate speech, and what were your findings in the survey about hate speech?
Well, hate speech is, as you indicate, an incredibly slippery thing to define. There is no First Amendment exception for hate speech, and we have to remind people of that all the time, that there is not some accepted definition of hate speech, and that is, again, where the crux of the matter lies. One can't define hate speech without telling someone that their political view is simply forbidden. And in this country, we've chosen a different course. We will allow folks to engage in hateful speech that would be banned in other countries, because we believe that allowing folks to voice that kind of speech allows people to react to it and to judge it and reject it in a more lasting way than just a simple state ban. Our survey indicated that students are very confused about, as are adults generally, students are not alone in this, are confused about the First Amendment's relationship to hate speech. 46% of students thought that hate speech was protected by the First Amendment, and 48% of students thought that the First Amendment should not protect hate speech. So it's a tricky issue. It's one of the things I talk about every time I go to campus. There's certain types of speech, true threats, harassment properly defined, that are not protected by the First Amendment. But just having a noxious view, racist, retrograde, homophobic, transphobic view, that's not alone enough to strip First Amendment protection. Again, as you said earlier, the best answer to those folks is more speech, not censorship. Censorship doesn't change minds.
Will Creeley, who's the Senior Vice President of Legal and Public Advocacy at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, is called FIRE. Tell us a little bit more about your organization and how people could get in touch with you.
Yeah, I'd be pleased to, and thanks again for having me. FIRE is a nonpartisan civil liberties organization that has been around since 1999, since being founded by Alan Charles Kors of the University of Pennsylvania, a historian coming from the right, and Harvey Silverglate, a civil liberties attorney and longtime criminal defense attorney, coming from more or less the other direction. And Harvey and Alan saw a problem on campuses nationwide. They were increasingly receiving reports of students being censored or punished or expelled without due process, and they thought that there was a need for a civil liberties group dedicated to higher education, and that's FIRE. We've been doing this work since 1999. You can find us online at thefire, thefire.org. And if you or anyone you know has concerns or has been censored on campus, please have them get in touch with us. Our case submissions increase annually, which is depressing, but sometimes we take some solace in the fact that perhaps that's because we're better known. So if anyone has a problem on campus and needs help with regard to their civil liberties, please have them contact us. We work proudly with groups from across the ideological spectrum, and we think we're very effective at what we do.
Well, before we let you go, I just have one final question, which I think is an appropriate note on which to end, and that's your prediction about what kind of societal consequences might flow from everything that you've been describing on college campuses. Do you expect the codification of stricter laws with respect to free speech if this trend continues?
Well, that's a great question. I could ask you, how much time do I have, right? My quick response would be that I am very concerned that increasingly on the campuses that I visit and the students I speak to, there's a growing perception that free speech is a partisan virtue, that it is designed to protect the speech of those we agree with. As Nat Hentoff would say, free speech for me, but not for thee. And that's depressing, and that's a problem. Now, if that trend continues, if me and my colleagues and groups like FIRE and the ACLU and others aren't able to educate folks, tomorrow's leaders, in the importance of protecting First Amendment values and preserving the First Amendment in the case law, then yeah, I worry very much about what that will look like 20 years downstream, where there will inevitably be efforts to codify stricter regulations on political speech. You know, I always remind students, we don't have the First Amendment to protect people posting pictures of kittens on Facebook, although we certainly would take a case like that. We have the First Amendment to protect the speech that most disturbs us, that most challenges our preconceptions. And we have to preserve that space in this country to allow for the continuing flourishing of democracy, right? You have to have the best arguments against your political opponents if you want to advance societal change. And you can't do that by simply sticking your head in the sand and pretending they don't exist. Again, censorship does not change minds. And that's actually a whole other show we could talk about, is the increasing move of societal discourse from the town square in real life to third-party groups like Facebook or Twitter, which, of course, are not bound by the First Amendment. I just see this morning that the actress Rose McGowan has been banned from Twitter for her comments about Ben Affleck and Harvey Weinstein. And I think if third-party groups or businesses like Twitter and Facebook have control of the virtual town square and are not bound by the First Amendment, we could see very quickly a stark illustration of why the First Amendment protections are so necessary, why making sure that all of us have recourse to free speech is so important.
Well, you got it. Another session on this exact topic. We'll wait a few weeks and then we'll have you on again. But it's continues to be fascinating and disturbing at the same time. It's really been an honor to meet you over the radio waves and to have your insights. And Michael and I look forward to talking again with you.
One more time. Tell us how people can get a hold of FIRE.
Thanks again. It's been an absolute pleasure and an honor here as well. Our website is thefire.org, thefire.org, and all of us are standing by. So I really look forward to speaking again, and thanks again for this great opportunity.
Will Creeley, really a great pleasure to
yes.
have you on Law and Disorder.
Thank
Take
you.
It easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Americans whose data is inadvertently swept up while the government monitors foreign intelligence risk having their information used for non-national security-related purposes. 2 weeks ago, draft legislation was introduced to address this, but a broad coalition of civil liberties organizations say it doesn't go far enough. They're calling on the House to close the so-called backdoor search loophole by requiring a warrant based on probable cause for any search of information about U.S. citizens and residents. Similar to the USA Freedom Act of 2015, which ended the practice of bulk surveillance of American citizens under Section 215 of the 2001 Patriot Act, the current legislation, the USA Liberty Act of 2017, would overhaul surveillance that's supposed to be limited to targets outside the U.S., but that actually affects Americans. Section 702 expires at the end of December, which is why Congress is reassessing the program now. Currently, FISA surveillance is conducted under a warrant issued annually by the FISA court for a list of foreign intelligence targets. But law enforcement can access and can use Americans' communications that are swept up in the FISA surveillance, and they don't need a warrant. This is even though U.S. persons' communications do require constitutional protections that aren't afforded to foreigners. The USA Liberty Act adds a warrant-like probable cause requirement before law enforcement can search the database. But the problem is, it also includes a sweeping and vague exception for, quote, foreign intelligence information, and does not stop law enforcement from using that information for criminal prosecutions. This is a glaring violation of the Fourth Amendment. Austin Carson, Executive Director of Tech Freedom, joins us to talk about this legislation and the state of surveillance in general. Tech Freedom is a nonprofit, nonpartisan technology think tank launched in 2011. It focuses on issues of internet freedom and technological process. Austin Carson, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And thanks for joining us from the busy airport. Austin, Tech Freedom and over 50 other organizations signed a letter calling for an end to the backdoor search loophole. How would you describe this loophole to a layperson?
The idea would be that information that is collected for purposes of surveilling foreign nationals for national security can then be used and queried without a warrant and could ostensibly be used for criminal purposes in some instances. Now, this isn't, I mean, I think to some large extent this is, at least from my perspective, somewhat prophylactic in nature. The idea is that you want to maintain the purpose of a statute and you want to make sure that it is used in a way that the American people can have some confidence in, the people that drafted the statute originally can have some confidence in, so that, you know, there's a lot of, I think, since Snowden revelations specifically, obviously, there's a pretty grand concern that, the national security apparatus could be used for some, you know, more nefarious purpose in the hands of, you know, somebody that we don't like. And I always think about it for lay people, like, the device from Batman Dark Knight, where he creates this huge machine to catch this, you know, deranged lunatic, and Morgan Freeman's obviously concerned about what it is. He's like, all right, I promise whenever we complete the purpose, you know, we'll destroy the machine. I think from an American layperson perspective, they just want to make sure that one day they don't find themselves a target of that machine.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah, really, I feel like I am a target of that machine. I mean, after the U.S. Patriot Act, after the attack on 9/11, and the Patriot Act was put in, I think we all felt like that. And my concern is, to what extent is that wholesale surveillance still going on?
Right. To some extent, I understand. You know, we've had conversations with. Well, first of all, when I worked in Congress, so for a little bit of background, I worked for a member on the Judiciary Committee for a couple of years, Blake Farenthold, and then after that worked for the Chairman of Homeland Security, Michael McCaul, for a couple of years. And on that side of it, you know, you have a lot of back and forth conversations with the folks that are drafting. When I was working for Mr. Farenthold, we, I think, were, you know, ended up being supportive of the USA Freedom Act to curtail some of the Section 215 authorities. But by comparison, you know, the Section 702 authorities are pretty universally described as highly meaningful for U.S. national security, right? There's not, you don't really have any back and forth as to whether or not it's meaningful or, you know, like a critical tool. However, the breadth of surveillance, I think, is also considered to be much wider. So that's obviously concerning. So to your point, you know, we've been talking to the people drafting legislation. We want to make sure that, you know, and are assured repeatedly, right, that these safeguards are in place, that, you know, what you can see from the FISA court is, you know, if something went awry, that they try to remedy it. You can see, you know, the CIA stopping about collection because they realized they had inadvertently slipped us information. And you constantly hear this drumbeat of, like, we don't want to re-erect pre-9/11 barriers to give ourselves blind spots for attack. But again, without transparency, without some type of meaningful statutory barriers in place, it's hard to have that trust, especially when it's a highly opaque circumstance for anybody not inside of it.
Austin, let's talk practically what a negative downside of the backdoor loophole could be. What kinds of communities might be impacted by the sweeping up, so-called inadvertently, of all this information on Americans?
So it's an interesting point, and I'm actually kind of glad I had a brief break to think about it slightly longer. On one hand, I think we hear on a regular basis about, you know, immigrant communities, specifically from Middle Eastern or other high-threat, considered to be high-threat area origin, folks that are talking to family back home, people that might be second or third order, you know, in some way linked to a foreign intelligence purpose, some or national security purpose impact. I mean, the especially for the perception for folks not living in the U.S. is that anything that they do that crosses over into U.S. communications channels is getting swept up, right? That's a common perception. Now, here's another interesting way to think about this. Even if you're not a part of an immigrant community, even if you're not having conversations with the family or friends back in, you know, Pakistan or Iraq or, you know, Egypt or something like that, you could very well be an international businessman. You could be anybody who has any sustained conversation with people doing land development. You could be talking to the Qataris, you know, about their investment fund and trying to figure out, have some big investment made in your real estate development business in New York City. You know, so there's a pretty broad cross-section of people that could hypothetically be swept up in this. And actually, I think that's why, to some extent, despite repeated requests from Chairman Goodlatte and Ranking Member Conyers from the House Judiciary Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee as well, that the NSA, the National Security Apparatus, has been unable to produce a number of American communications that have been swept up. And I'm not sure if that's from technical means or from trying to bound that in a reasonable criterion that wouldn't scare the hell out of everybody.
We're talking with Austin Carson from Tech Freedom. Austin, on October 5th of this month, the New York Times ran a piece called The End of Privacy, and it mentioned two huge accounts that have been compromised. One we know about, 3 billion Yahoo emails accounts in 2013, and then the Equifax scandal, 143 million credit reports this September. And this is in addition to the leaking of nearly 200 million U.S. voter records this past June. Do you think that American privacy has ended, and why or why not?
Well, I try to avoid, so I forget who coined the term, but somebody coined the term the privacy nihilist, the idea that there is so much information out there. It is all has leaked or is going to leak. You might as well stop, you know, taking all these measures to try to protect yourself. But I'll say, I mean, I think that privacy at this point is becoming something like security, in the context that it's not necessarily about being completely private or completely secure. It's about running a little bit faster than the guy behind you so that he gets eaten by the bear, you know? So I actually was having this conversation yesterday on a panel at Austin Startup Week, and going with some security practitioners who I wish were here with me to answer this, because they're far more eloquent on the topic than I am. But the real thrust of it is these are still somewhat abstract, the American people. I mean, Equifax less so than the Yahoo breach, because you got to freeze your credit score if you're impacted and you know are trying to take wise steps. And there are more practical impacts. If you have an account opened up, it will become very practical for you in the near future. But at some juncture in the not distant future, we're going to have a meaningful kinetic attack from a cybersecurity perspective. It's going to be how, you know, the boilers in your home are going to be, you know, turned up without what the external control, and house is going to explode, or, you know, part of the grid is going to get taken down by a foreign adversary, or who knows, even a hacktivist might, like, disable some, you know, might find some vulnerability in something and finally be fed up by the lack of willingness to address it and mass brick, you know, a bunch of, you know, something that'll cause a actual uproar, right? And in that instance, I think we will find a way to refocus our attention on security, which will also have the collateral benefit of refocusing our attention on privacy. Because the idea that data can be exfiltrated at will, because we don't really understand how to secure systems, will fade, and we will reinforce our privacy. Now, on the other hand, to the point of the backdoor loophole, the first time that it's not like a cartel leader or somebody providing material support from terrorists or to terrorists through like their drug operations that gets arrested through parallel construction or through taking information that should have been collected to prevent a direct attack and using it for an indirect matter, and it's, you know, Jim Bob down the street who had invoked the ire of, you know, his local sheriff and then got information on him from some whatever, you know, some database, and then got locked away for, you know, smoking weed or something, and all of a sudden you're like, yeah, well, it wasn't like Jim Bob was doing the best thing, but that definitely doesn't seem like it jives with the purpose of FISA Amendments Act, right? Then people will start to question that, and then it'll be about like, okay, how comfortable are we really with having this much information out there and having it shared? I mean, I think it's a pendulum like all things. I don't think we're moving towards a panopticon, but I will say I think we have further to go before we reverse course.
I like your point about being awakened in effect by an attack that really hits home to people how they can personally be impacted, whether it's the electric grid or financial systems. Let's hope it doesn't come all at once in what some people deem a cyber 9/11. But I do think the hacks that we've been seeing around the globe and in this country really point to the inadequacy of security protections by the parts of U.S. corporations and governments that hackers have been finding and trying to share and point out. Our policies are deplorable about that.
I'd just like to echo that point. Yeah. And I think if there's one thing that we could do, you know, there's a wide-ranging conversation around how, you know, how or if we should regulate the emerging fields of cybersecurity, whether or not the federal government, you know, the NIST framework for cyber hygiene and other frameworks that have been put forward are sufficient to be some type of baseline, if we should put those in statute. But I will say if there is one obvious thing that we could do to make the entire ecosystem work better, it would be further our collaboration with well-intentioned, quote, white hat security researchers. Like, in full stop, to find the most effective ways to go about doing that from both the government and private sector level is, in my view, mission critical, because the code is made by humans. It is easily broken.
Correct. I totally agree with you on that. Austin, I wish we could have this conversation maybe again when you're not rushing to catch a plane. We appreciate your calling in, and when we can have a little more leisurely discussion. But it was wonderful of you to join us. We really admire the work of Tech Freedom, and again, in a month or two, we'd love to have you back on to talk about the other things you're working on.
Sounds great. I would love to do it, and I really enjoy the conversation. Thank you for having me.
Austin Carson of Tech Freedom, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
Bye-bye.
All right. Y'all too. Take care of yourselves.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.